You've heard the maxim, the saying, the one who dies with the most money wins. I've seen variations of that as well. The first variation off of that I saw was in a fabric shop. My wife used to take me there until I began destroying things inadvertently. But there on the side of next to the wall, next to the door, on the side wall, was the sign that said, "The one who dies with the most material wins." And then, of course, there's the Texas version, "The one who dies with the most guns wins." Obviously, the sarcasm of those sayings is patent. We recognize the greediness and the materialism of those kinds of statements. Ironically, they also contain a certain amount of scriptural truth, perhaps unintended. That is, you can't take it with you. You really don't win when you die with the most money or the most material or the most Legos, children. You really don't win because if you die with those things, you don't get to take it with you. Materialism is a topic that is not often addressed, perhaps from the pulpit, in large part because most of us don't really think it's that big of a temptation. If I asked you, or if we were to poll the people of our congregation this morning, and ask you if money and riches were a temptation to you, most of you would say, "No, I don't have enough riches to be tempted with. That's not a problem for me." Perhaps some of you might like to try the temptation just to see how you fare. But if we really were to answer the question, is greediness a problem? Most of us would say no. And I think that answer, that negative reply, in large part comes from the fact that we don't understand what greediness really is. What materialism really is. A poor person can be materialistic. A middle-class, blue-collar union worker can be materialistic. And the richest man on the earth can still be greedy. We automatically assume that only certain classes of people have problems with the temptation of materialism and riches, when in fact it's a heart issue, not an economic one. It's a heart attitude. It's a way of thinking, not how much money or material or guns do you have. Paul has been ministering in Ephesus in the book of Acts chapter 19. He's been there for about 2 years now. And his ministry has been so effective that Luke records that the word of God grew mightily and prevailed. And so much so that in the 2 years that he had this rented facility, that the name of the Lord Jesus was magnified, and all those who lived in Asia Minor heard the word of the Lord. Now, obviously, they didn't all convert. They didn't all become Christians, but they all at least heard of the gospel. Tremendous ministry of the Apostle Paul. Satan, however, is never content to allow God to work without some sort of counterattack. And I might add that God permits Satan to counterattack at times, and here we have such an example. In this particular counterattack, Satan uses means, and the means he uses is a man by the name of Demetrius, a man of obvious, bold greed and materialism. And what I want us to do this morning is that as we go through the passage here, look at the character of Demetrius. Look at what he says. sort of read between the lines. Listen to the way he puts things. Because in doing so, we're going to be able to look at a greedy man in action. It's as if someone were to take a camera and go back in time and videotape Demetrius for us and say, here is what a materialistic mind looks like. This is how it acts. Luke has recorded that for us. He gives us the story and the effect that this one man has on his fellow craftsmen and upon the whole city. Let's get a little background information, if you will. If you'll remember, Ephesus is in that area. It's now modern-day Turkey, that peninsula that sticks out on the northern part of the Mediterranean. And Ephesus was on the southwest coast area of modern-day Turkey, or what was then called Asia or Asia Minor. Ephesus was noted for a lot of things. It was noted for its magic and its magical schools. You could go there and learn to be a wizard or a magician or an exorcist or whatever you wanted. It was also noted, probably mostly, for the Temple of Diana, one of the seven wonders of the world. Don't ask me what the other six are. I might be able to name one or two. But the Temple of Diana was noted as one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. When it was built, it took over 200 years to build. Now think about that. If the high five in Dallas isn't done in 7 years, we're complaining. We are so prone to instant construction that something that takes 200 years to build baffles our minds. And it wasn't because they were using slave labor that it took so long. It's because they wanted it perfect. It was built primarily out of white marble, and each stone was polished by hand until it could reflect the person looking at it, the workman. So that you have this gleaming, white, brilliant marble temple. It was approximately 350 feet long and about 150 feet wide. It was surrounded by columns all the way around. And these columns were about 50 or 55 feet tall, themselves made out of marble, and the column head out of carvings that were said to be absolutely beautiful. In the inner chamber, towards the front of the temple, there was a secluded chamber. Sequestered and in secret was the idol of Diana, a carved idol that represented this goddess of the Greeks and Romans. And supposedly this idol fell down from heaven. There are actually several accounts in the old times of idols that fell from heaven. And it's possible that this was some sort of a meteorite stone that fell from heaven and then someone took and carved into an idol or just started worshiping. So in the inner chamber was an idol of Diana. And the legend was that Zeus himself sent down this statue so that she could be properly worshipped. To the side of that chamber, where the goddess resided, was a bank. A place where the princes and the kings and the wealthy men of the Roman Empire could safely deposit their money without fear that it would be stolen, robbed, or that they themselves would somehow be cheated. The Temple of Diana was more than just a worship place. It was a place of commerce. This is, if you will, the Swiss bank of the Roman Empire. A nice, safe, trustworthy place for the rich. So this story about Paul and Diana and Demetrius, it's not just about gods, although it certainly is the foundation of it. It's also about banking. It's about money. It's about world finance. It's about reputations. We're talking about international riches that are at stake. We are then introduced in the story to a man by the name of Demetrius. And in verses 23 through 27, we're introduced to him. where his identity is given to us, and then we have recorded for us the speech that he gives. First of all, his identity in verse 23 and verse 24. About that time, there arose a great commotion about the way. And the way is Christianity, not just as a belief, but as a belief system. The way of the disciples. A certain man named Demetrius, a silversmith, who made silver shrines of Diana, brought no small profit to the craftsmen. So there are at least three things here, four things actually, that we want to bring out. First of all, his name, Demetrius. He's a silversmith. He's a talented man. He would take silver and craft it into all sorts of shapes. It might be silver plates or jewelry or any number of things. But in particular, most of his money, we are told, comes from the fact that he made shrines. Now, these shrines could be any size. A large number of them for the tourists. You know, you went to see Ephesus as a tourism spot, like you might go to Zurich or Geneva in Switzerland. And for the tourists, there were necklaces made out of silver, and on the end of them, where the pendant would just be a small replica of the Temple of Diana. Or there might be a small replica of the idol of Diana itself. And these were made out of silver, and Demetrius made them and, of course, sold them. Some of the shrines might be larger. Some of them might be a shrine that a rich person and a devotee of Diana would buy and take home and put in his house or her house. And that would become the family place of worship, the family shrine. And there would be a silver image of the temple or of Diana herself or both, as the case may be. Finally, we're told that he brought a profit, no small profit, meaning a huge profit, to himself and, of course, to the craftsmen of the city. So Demetrius' work as a silversmith was a trickle-down effect, if you will. What he earned profited not only himself, but it profited other businesses as well. Maybe there were, you know, food servers. So the tourists would come in to see the temple, they'd buy something from Demetrius, and then they'd go have lunch right next door. There might be restaurants. There might be other craftsmen selling other trinkets. And one business just kind of fed off of the other. This is Demetrius. And in verses 24 through 27, he gives us, or excuse me, 25 through 27, he gives us his speech. And his speech is recorded for us so that we would understand his character. First of all, although not specifically mentioned, we need to understand his depravity. In the paragraph that's gone on before, God has been working some extraordinary miracles through Paul. Sweat cloths, handkerchiefs used by Paul have been taken out to the sick and they have gotten healed. Work aprons, like a tanner or a leather worker might wear to protect his clothes. Portions of them, or maybe the whole apron, taken to people possessed by evil spirits. And the evil spirits are cast out. Some tremendous miracles worked by Paul and by Paul alone. And Demetrius hears the gospel. Demetrius sees these miracles. And his hard heart refuses to believe and bow. Don't think for one minute that somehow if you just have the right argument or the right spiritual power or the right miracle were performed, that somehow unbelievers are going to go, oh, I guess there really is a God and Jesus Christ really is His Son, and through force of logic be converted. It will never happen. We are born blind. We are born desperately wicked. We are born self-deceitful. And like Demetrius, the miracle can happen before our eyes. And if the Spirit of God does not work, we will ignore it. That's what you were before the Holy Spirit opened your eyes. That's what all men are who need to hear the gospel. blinded and willfully blinded, one and the same time. Demetrius hears, and his greed, his depravity, ignores the truth. Christ Himself said, if they do not hear the word, they won't believe if one rises from the dead. And the implication being that they're standing right there to see it. They still won't believe. So the first thing we need to learn about Demetrius is that the context in which he is set shows his depravity. His greed is his blindness. His materialism is his religion. And he will not give up one religion for another. Second thing about him is that his greed pretends to be the best interest of other people. In verse 25, he says, men, he's got these craftsmen together, those of a similar occupation. Men, you know that we have our prosperity by this trade. Translation, I'm not thinking of myself here. I'm thinking of all of us. You know, this isn't just Demetrius who's got a problem. We are all in the same boat. He's trying to get a crowd together. He's trying to get a mob going. So he affects this idea. I'm just interested in your benefit. Surely you've seen them, right? On television? Particularly on a Saturday. Flip the channels. And there's Mr. So-and-so with his how to make $1 million in the next 2 years scheme. And why is he telling you about it? Well, he's already made the money that he wants to make. He just wants to share it with you. That's all. For $45 in the cost of postage and handling. He wants to share it with you. I read a story one time of an ad that came out in the Chicago Tribune in the wanted ads. Send me $1 and I will tell you how to get rich. You know how many people sent money to that thing? Hundreds of thousands. You know what they got back for their $1? A letter that said, go to a city and take out an ad that says, send me $1 and I'll show you how to get rich. It's just your best interests. That's all. Beware of people who have your best interest at heart for a price. That's Demetrius, his greed. It pretends to be interested in other people's business, pretends to be interested in their best interests, I should say. Also in verse 26, greed often plays upon religious ignorance. It is not just the atheists and the secularists and the ungodly, you know, whoever out there that are the greedy people. Quite often, those who appear to be religious are just as greedy. Verse 26, Demetrius says, moreover, you see and hear that not only at Ephesus, but throughout almost all Asia, this Paul has persuaded and turned away many people, saying that they are not gods which are made with hands. Now, here's what Demetrius is saying. Just because I manufacture this god doesn't mean that it's not really a god. You know that. I know that. But this Paul is going around telling people that simply because it's man-made that it's not an idol, that it's not really a god. Now, think of the religious ignorance that's involved with that. Turn, if you will, Isaiah chapter 44, because Isaiah says it better than I ever could. Of course. Isaiah 44 and verse 9. Those who make a graven image, all of them are useless, and their precious things shall not profit. They are their own witnesses. They neither see nor know, that they may be ashamed. Who would form a god or cast a graven image that profits him nothing? Surely all his companions would be ashamed. And the workmen, they are mere men. Let them all be gathered together. Let them stand up. Yet they shall fear, and they shall be ashamed together. The blacksmith with the tongs works one in the coals, fashions it with hammers, works it with the strength of his own arms. And even so, he is hungry, and his strength fails. If he drinks no water, he is faint. The craftsman stretches out his rule. He marks one, marks an idol, that is, out with his chalk. He fashions it with a plane. He marks it out with the compass and makes it like the figure of a man, according to the beauty of a man, that it may remain in the house. He hews down cedars for himself and takes the cypress or the oak. He secures it for himself among the trees of the forest. He plants a pine. The rain nourishes it. Then it shall be for a man to burn. For he will take some of it and warm himself. Yes, he kindles it and bakes bread. Indeed, he makes a god and worships it. He makes it a carved image and falls down to it. He burns half of it in the fire. With this half he eats meat, he roasts a roast and is satisfied. He even warms himself and says, I am warm, I've seen the fire. And the rest of it he makes into a god, his carved image. He falls down before it and worships it, prays to it and says, deliver me, for you are my God. They do not know nor understand, for he has shut their eyes so that they cannot see, and their hearts so that they cannot understand. And no one considers in his heart, nor is there knowledge nor understanding to say, I've burned half of it in the fire, I've also baked bread on its coals and roasted meat and eaten it, and shall I make the rest of it an abomination? Shall I fall down before a block of wood? He feeds on ashes. A deceived heart has turned him aside, and he cannot deliver his soul, nor say, is there not a lie in my right hand? The absolute ridiculousness of Demetrius' statement. Demetrius takes silver and he pounds it, and he heats it, and he purifies it. And he pounds it some more, and he shapes it, and he carves it, and he etches it. And then he bows down before it and calls it a god or a goddess. Demetrius is playing upon the religious ignorance of the people. He's not the first, and he's not the last. Some of the richest people have gotten that way through greed that plays off of the religious fears of others. Throughout history, you can find where the Roman Catholic Church has done so. With its doctrine of purgatory, it has used that idea to solicit money. Modern day extreme charismatics of the same notion. Protestants, Anglicans, oh yes, and Baptists, use the religious ignorance of their people to raise offerings and money and riches, and greed and materialism play upon religious ignorance and foolishness. Third thing in this speech is that we see that greed often wants to deny freedom to somebody else for its own self-protection. Greed wants to deny a freedom to someone else so that it can protect itself or its own interests. Verse 27, Demetrius says, because of Paul's gospel witness, so not only is this trade of ours in danger of falling into disrepute, but also the temple of the great goddess Diana may be despised and her magnificence destroyed, whom all Asia and the world worships. Bottom line, what Demetrius is saying is this. This Paul is a dangerous fellow and we need to do something about him. We need to get rid of him. If he's left to go unchecked at this rate, nobody will be worshiping Diana. And if nobody's worshiping Diana, then I can't make silver shrines. And if I don't make silver shrines, then your business is going down. And if our businesses go down, even the temple itself will be in disrepute and disuse. And then what's going to happen to our bank and our idol and our means of living? The whole world will be turned upside down. We've got to get rid of this Paul for our own good. We can't let him preach the gospel anymore. We've got to deny him freedom. Look at how much change will happen if Paul's allowed to have his way. Get rid of his freedom to speak so that we can protect ourselves. Everybody is in favor of freedom until they're in charge. And then all of a sudden, freedom's not such a good idea. Everybody's in favor of a fair market until they've cornered the market. Everybody wants equality as long as I'm on the lower end of things. Everybody demands equalization as long as it's not my money being equalized. One of the great quotes was an interview back in the late 70s. There were tensions between what was then the Soviet Union. Isn't that nice to talk about? What was then the Soviet Union and communist China. And they never liked each other a whole lot. And so at one point, some tensions had mounted and they were starting to pile up some troops along the Sino-Soviet border. And an American journalist went to talk to some of the Chinese troops, some of the Soviet troops. And he was interviewing these Russian soldiers and asked them what their greatest fear was. And they said, the Chinese. He said, you're not afraid of the Americans. Oh, no. The Americans have never really attacked us. I'm not afraid of them. Why are you afraid of the Chinese? The soldier replied, because I just bought a motorcycle. The journalist said, I'm sorry, I don't see the connection. He said, simple. The communist Chinese take everything. And if they come and take over Russia, they're going to take my motorcycle. This was a man from a communist nation afraid that somebody was going to take his motorcycle. You're not afraid of the Americans invading and taking over. Oh no, the Americans respect private property. We're always wanting freedom, or at least freedom is touted, until, of course, that person is on top. This is Demetrius and this is his character. In verses 28 through 29, we get a reaction of the businessmen and of the townspeople. And the only way I can phrase it is that there is this rage that just grows. It just kind of snowballs. So in verse 28, the craftsmen begin by crying out, "Great is Diana, goddess of the Ephesians!" As if that had anything to do with what they were talking about. But they're in a rage now. What they really mean, of course, is great is our money, and we don't want anybody messing with it, but they're going to disguise it as religious affection. So great is Diana, goddess of the Ephesians. And sooner or later, some people around them begin to hear, and the next thing you know, the whole city is filled with confusion, and they're all rushing to the amphitheater where they took care of their business, kind of like City Hall. Only it's more the size of Cowboy Stadium than City Hall. But that's where they took care of their business. So they're all, you know, rushing there. And the Scriptures tell us that most of them don't even know what they're going there for. Just the whole city seems to be in an uproar and the whole city is headed for the amphitheater. So let's go and find out what's going on. And confusion reigns. So there's this chaos. Paul wants to go in verses 30 and 31. And even the officials of Asia, the Roman officials, ask him not to go in. Just let this thing die out. And then the Jews put forth somebody named Alexander in verse 33. And Alexander is going to make some sort of a speech to the people. And when they find out he's a Jew, they don't even want to listen to him. Interesting point, by the way. The Jews, who believe in one God, were in Ephesus for centuries. And Diana worship was never in any danger from them. Paul is there for 2 years, and they're worried about being shut down. interesting. Finally, the assembly is dismissed by the city clerk, which would be like the mayor of the city, not so much the county clerk as we know it. And he says, look, if this is a matter for the courts, let it be handled in the courts. Otherwise, let's just dismiss this assembly, because if the Romans hear about it and Caesar hears about it, he's going to want to know why we had this mob. He's going to think we're planning a revolt. He's going to think that we're planning some sort of an insurrection. And if that happens, the Romans are going to come in. They're going to take over the city, and nobody's going to be in charge of anything. So let's go home and be quiet. Self-interest. And he dismisses the assembly. What are we to learn from this passage then? What are some doctrines, some ideas, and some personal applications we need to make? First of all, we need a good biblical doctrinal understanding of what greed and materialism really is. Because our society does not have a good understanding of greed and materialism. If you think of riches and the Old Testament, some of the richest people were God's saints. Abraham, Isaac and Jacob, Job. Joseph was second in command to the richest nation in the world at the time. He wasn't just rich, he owned it for all intents and purposes. The greatest rich people of the Old Testament often were God's saints. Conversely, some of the poorest people in the Old Testament were God's saints. Naomi comes back from Moab without her husband, without her sons, only with Ruth, no property that she owns, and they're living off of what Ruth can glean from the fields after the harvesters. They're living off of welfare, to put it in modern day terminology. Social welfare system. Elijah, out living on a riverbank somewhere and living off of the food that God has the birds bring him. That's breakfast, lunch, and dinner, whatever the ravens bring you. The richest and the poor have all been God's people. Jesus Christ Himself said, I don't have a house. I don't have a place to lay my head. He was not a rich person, despite what some might have you believe. Materialism and greed are not measured in terms of money or the amount of it or the lack of it. Materialism and greed are idolatrous religions. And therefore, they are not measured in terms of how much money you have or how much money you don't have. They are measured in terms of where your heart is. And that is the definition of materialism and greed we have to have from a biblical perspective. Our nation just goes back and forth on the hinges of different viewpoints about money. I don't mind taxes being raised as long as it's your money being paying for the taxes. That's the general idea. I don't want the government intruding in my business, but I want the government to solve my problems. I don't want the government taking what I have earned, but I don't mind them taking what you have earned. Especially if you're rich. And we have become a materialistic nation, not so much in the fact that we own so much stuff, but because of the attitude of our hearts towards money. Money is not the root of all evil. The love of money is the root of all evil. It's the heart attitude that makes one a materialistic, greedy person. And you can be poor and be greedy. Or you can be rich and be greedy. Or you can be rich and be content. It's not the amount. It's the attitude. Materialism is measured not in terms of how much money you have, but in your attitude towards it. And there are different forms that materialism takes. The first one is Money equals happiness. I love money because money makes me happy. The old saying, money can't buy me happiness. Money can't buy me love either if you're a beetle. You have to be at least 35 to understand that, okay? Teenagers, don't worry about it. Your parents will explain it later. Okay, maybe money can't buy happiness, but then the reply is, but I'd like to try and see how close I can get. Money equals happiness. If I just had more money, I'd be happy. Now, usually we're not so blatant about it. Usually we're not so obvious about it. Usually it's a little bit more subtle. So that instead of thinking in terms of money, we think in terms of what money buys. I would be happy if I just had a bigger house. Wives, see your husbands. Honey, I'd be a lot happier if I just had a bigger kitchen. I'd be happy if I just had a newer car. I could really be happy, boy, if I had that. You know, I have to watch where I go in Fry's because I see those big screen TVs. I thought, man, I'd be happy if I had one of those. Until it breaks. Money equals happiness. Probably men are more prone to that than women. But the next one I'm going to mention, I think women may be more prone to, and that is money equals security. I know things will be okay tomorrow because I've got X number of dollars today. So, if something happens tomorrow, one of the kids breaks an arm or a leg or both, we're okay. We got the insurance or the money to pay for it. I'm secure. I know things are going to be all right because we've got X number of dollars in the bank. The checking account looks good. We've got retirement. And everything's okay because I've got money. Or vice versa. Things are rotten because we don't have money. Something terrible could happen tomorrow and we don't have the money to pay for it. The car could break down and we don't have any money to buy a new one. The house could burn down and we don't have enough insurance to pay for it. And we can't afford more insurance. Somebody could get dramatically sick. One of us could become disabled, blind, crippled, whatever. And it would be terrible because we don't have enough money to handle it. Money becomes security. Materialism takes another form where money becomes achievement. The reason the one who dies with the most money wins is because when he dies or she dies, their name goes down in the history books as one of the richest people ever. It's achievement. It's fame. Everybody's heard of Rockefeller. Right? Everybody knows about Rockefeller. Everybody's heard, most people have heard the name of J. Paul Getty. Howard Hughes. Bill Gates. Steve Forbes. Rich people generally are famous people. We know that. And we think if I can just get money, they'll remember my name for 100 years. People will respect me. I'll walk into a restaurant and whether I got a reservation or not, I can get a seat. I can do the same thing, it's just at Burger King. Then there's another form that materialism takes, and I call this reverse materialism. It's the belief that being rich is automatically evil. If you're rich, you must be evil. Must be something wrong with you. And this sort of materialism actually says, I'm poor and therefore I'm good. I haven't got a penny to my name. Aren't I spiritual? I don't own anything. I must be a holy person. And I would never, ever taint my life or my pure heart by desiring anything materialistic. that's just as materialistic as somebody who thinks that money is success, is happiness. Because it measures goodness on the basis of how much money one has. And that's the key attitude. My life is good. My future will be good. My fame is good. My reputation is good because I have X number of dollars. And whether that's 40 billion or 40 cents, somehow we measure the goodness of ourselves on the basis of what we have. I'm happy because I have plenty of money or plenty of toys or plenty of clothes or plenty of whatever. Or I'm happy because I'm poor and proud of it. The other side of this, doctrinally speaking, is that because materialism and greed is a heart attitude, because it's an idolatry, you cannot serve both God and money. Jesus makes this plain. One of them is going to win out. You can try for a while, like walking a fence line. You might make two or three steps, but sooner or later, one of them is going to demand your attention. And to whom you give the priority will determine who your God really is. There will come a point where you will have to decide which one you really love, God or money. You may be in a situation where you need to get a job, but there's this little thing called morality stepping in the way. And if you'll just be a little bit unethical, you can get a promotion. You can get prestige. There's this thing that you want, brand new car, new house. But in order to get there, you have to start working overtime on a regular basis, voluntarily. And so you volunteer for this overtime, and your church attendance begins to slack off on the weekends because you're tired. You're at work, and you're hoping for a promotion or just simply for the boss to notice you because you want that raise or that award at the end of the year. And so you slack off on your witnessing because you don't want the boss thinking you're some sort of religious fanatic. All of these are symptoms and signs of where God and money come to a head. And oftentimes we choose the money. Just lie a little bit on your taxes and you get a much bigger refund or have to pay less taxes. Push that loophole to its farthest extreme. Claim your dog as a dependent. Whatever it takes. Hey, I've worked for Social Security long enough to know it happens. People even invented Social Security numbers for their pets. Just to get more money. Let's ask ourselves some questions. How do I know if I have an unbiblical love of money? How can I detect that in myself? And I think Jesus, as the master physician and psychologist, gives us the answers in Matthew chapter 6, the Sermon on the Mount. Turn there if you will, please. What are the symptoms of an unbiblical view of money? We've already mentioned the first one in verse 24, that no one can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will be loyal to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and money. Matthew 6:25, therefore I say to you, do not worry about your life. That's the first sign. When there's a lack of money, you start worrying. When God in His providence decides that you're going to get laid off from your job, or God in His providence decides that the stock market is going to dip down and your 401k or your savings plan is going down with it, When God in His providence puts you in a financially tight situation, or even when He does not, and things are going well, but you start looking towards the future in retirement, you're worrying. How am I going to get enough money to survive retirement? How am I going to get enough money to pay for all the medical bills that are going to happen as I get older? How am I going to get enough money to pay for my parents' nursing home or my nursing home when I get there? Worry. Jesus says, do not worry about your life. Don't worry about having enough food. Don't worry about having clothing. And I think by implication, don't even worry about a house. God knows you have need of such things. God will provide your needs. I've never yet seen the righteous forsaken or his seed begging for bread. God knows, and God will provide. It may not be in the way you wish. The food may come from a raven instead of a fancy restaurant. But God will provide. Worry, that's the first sign. The second, your thoughts, your energies, and your daydreams about treasure. Look back at verse 19, if you will, of Matthew 6. Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth. Where is your focus? Where is your mindedness? What do you think of most? When you are planning, what do you spend most of your time planning on? When you daydream, what do you daydream? How often do you daydream about going out to the mailbox and finding a lottery ticket that you didn't buy, since we're Baptists? And it's a winning lottery ticket. Now, you have to be ethical even in your daydreams, you understand. You have to be moral and upstanding even when you're thinking. Or finding out that you're the long-lost heir of some super rich person who recently died and now, you know, you just inherited $1 million, $2 million, $3 million dollars. Why stop there? You know, let's just make it $10 million and go. What's your focus of attention? When Jesus in this passage talks about the eye, the lamp of the, verse 22, the lamp of the body is the eye. Therefore, your eye is good, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eye is bad, your whole body will be full of darkness. I think one of the things he's referring to is the idea of our focus. What do we look at? What do we focus on? How are we defining and filtering the world around us? Are we looking for riches? Jesus said, look for heavenly riches. How often do you console yourself, comfort yourself, encourage yourself with this thought that heaven will be a place of riches beyond what you can understand? And I don't mean materialistic, sensual riches. You got $40 million and you get to spend it all on yourself. I mean godly, holy riches where throughout eternity you will serve one another and God with beauty that you can't even begin to imagine. Where do you attempt to put your treasure? Do you wish you had more money so your future would be secure? Matthew 6, verse 25, when Jesus says, don't worry, in verse 26, look at the birds of the air. They neither sow nor reap nor gather into barns. They're not saving up for tomorrow. Yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Now, this verse is not a verse that says you can't have savings accounts, you can't plan for tomorrow. That's not the point. The point is the heart attitude. Would you feel safer if you had more money? In other words, where is your trust? Is your trust in the amount of money you have? Or is your trust in God? I think a fourth symptom, how do I know if I have an unbiblical love of money, is I begin to define the beauty of something primarily by how much it costs. Verse 28, why do you worry about clothing? Consider the lilies of the field, how they grow. They neither toil nor spin. And yet I say to you that even Solomon in all his glory was not arrayed like one of these. You begin to interpret the beauty of something by how much it costs. How beautiful is that engagement ring? Well, I don't know. How much did it cost him? How many of you remember something called a fashion statement back in, I think it was the late 80s, called shotgun jeans? Well, I mean, you know, there for a while you bought the jeans, the fashionable jeans, with the knees torn open, right? And some Western guy, maybe it was just a local West Texas fad, I don't know, because that's where I was at the time, got the idea that instead of just ripping open the jeans, let's take them out to a gun range and let's shoot them once or twice with a 12-gauge shotgun from a distance, you know, so the nice big dispersion. And you bought these jeans pre-washed with little, you know, buckshot holes in them. Well, it probably wasn't buckshot. It was probably number 8 or something. And the price of these things was astronomical. I kept looking for blood stains, but, you know, they weren't there. They did take them off. And everybody thought, man, that's cool. That's just really cool. And their value of it was based upon two things. One, it was fashionable. And two, they were expensive. I remember in high school, if you dared showed up with something like Kmart jeans, and everybody else had, you know, Jordache or Levi's, the beauty of it was determined by how much it costs. Beware of passing such attitudes down to your children. The second question we need to ask ourselves is that if we see such things in ourselves, are we teaching our children the same? Adults, hear this warning. If you have problems with materialism, it's not you who will deny the faith. It's your children. They will begin to think that Christianity is nothing more than another form of idolatrous materialism. And it's they who will grow up and devote themselves to money and not God. Moses warned the children of Israel that they were going to go into a land that inhabited with cities and vineyards and fields and orchards that they didn't build and they didn't plant. But that there was going to come a time when their children would say, look at what I have done. That's Moses' warning. We also need to ask ourselves about thankfulness. How do I know if I have an unbiblical love of money? Am I thankful? And thankfulness is not just a prayer before a meal. Thankfulness is not just saying, God, I thank you. Thankfulness is, God gave it, and God can take it away. And so if I have it, it's because God gave it. And I will not take it for granted. In closing, I'd like to remind you of this. That when Paul was talking about using money for the kingdom of God, using money to help the benevolent in benevolent situations, using money to further the gospel and to help other saints, he reminded them in 2 Corinthians chapter 8 and verse 9 that Jesus Christ was rich, and yet for your sakes he became poor. And I don't think we can even begin to imagine that kind of riches. But he gave it all up to come and live like one of us, without a home, without money, to be cursed, to be spit upon, to be mocked, and to be crucified, so that you could be saved. Our greatest riches is not our bank account, and the point of our trust is not our credit cards. It's that Jesus Christ, the Creator of all, gave up all so that we could have all. Where is your faith? Is it in yourself? Or is it in the death of the suffering Savior?